The following is a production of the People of Mars Hill. For more information, visit pomh.org.
If you're new with us this morning, we've been moving our way through the book of Ruth and taking it pieces at a time. Today, we're going to tackle the whole chapter 3 because it wouldn't really make a whole lot of sense to break it up. You really need to see the context of this whole thing. But you've got Ruth, you've got Naomi, who are two widows. Naomi has lost everything. She's lost her husband. She's lost her sons, who Ruth was married to one of those sons. And so these are two widows that find themselves back in Israel and Judah and are presented with some interesting situations. Ruth chapter 3 is without a doubt the most challenging chapter of the book of Ruth. That's why Kyle went out of town today. As you start to read very quickly, it looks like a terrible wrong turn is about to be made, that Ruth is about to really make some bad decisions. The tension begins to build, and you're beginning to wonder, where is this going to go? But it's also arguably the most helpful chapter in the book of Ruth. It's filled with moral ambiguities. It's also filled with insight into the complexities and the contradictions of a redeemed human heart. It shows us ourselves, and it overflows with hints of God's sovereignty, of God's mercy, of God's grace. It shows us how God, in his sovereign mercy, superintends even our sin for his glory. Ultimately, Ruth chapter 3 points us to the gospel of grace. We see ourselves as we are. Those of us that have been redeemed by Christ, we see ourselves in the contradictions, the wrestling that you and I have every single day of what our soul ultimately desires in pleasing God and what our flesh desires in pleasing itself. And so we see a raw version of ourselves, but we also see Jesus. There's no greater tension in the book of Ruth than here in chapter 3. The author shrouds it in darkness and mystery and intrigue. There's sexual innuendos and double entendres in this that we'll see, and I'll do my best to keep it clean. And the part of the story takes place at night in secrecy. It leaves our minds interested. It leaves our minds wondering, how far is this really going to go? So structurally, the chapter parallels with chapter 2 quite similarly. We see chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3. There's these chiastic structures that we see that everything is pointing to a specific purpose, a specific point in the story. And so just like chapter 2, chapter 3 begins with a discussion between Naomi and Ruth. And then we see in the middle of the chapter, there's this conversation. There's something happening between Ruth and Boaz. And then we end the chapter again with this conversation between Ruth and Naomi. So both of these conversations that sandwich this conversation between Ruth and Boaz, these conversations between Ruth and Naomi are pointing us to the purpose of this chapter. What's the point of this chapter? And so the point of this chapter is the conversation that we see between Ruth and Boaz. And as we move through this chapter, you're going to see where the author begins to stop using names, and he starts to use the pronouns him or he or her, a man, woman. He doesn't use their names anymore, because I think he's pointing us to something a little bit deeper in that there's a relationship here between a man and a woman, and the names are not as important as what's happening. And so I want us to understand that as we move through chapter 3, the author makes a shift for a little while to point us to the point. The last verse of chapter 2 explains that the barley and the wheat harvests are over now. Ruth has been going out every day, working in the heat, working all day long with Boaz and the other women that go out into the field. And they've been working and doing these things for the harvest season. And now the end of the season is here. Chapter 2 lets us know that the harvest is over. And what we know now, moving into chapter 3, is that some time has passed, maybe even a few months has passed between chapter 2 and chapter 3. And so at the end of chapter 2, Naomi has this hope within her. She sees somewhat of maybe there's a connection with Boaz and Ruth, and maybe Boaz can be this kinsman redeemer that's going to save Ruth from being this widow and not having the inheritance that she could have and living what she would consider a disgraceful life as a widow and not being able to remarry. And so Naomi is wanting Ruth to be rescued from that. And so she sees maybe there's this connection between Boaz. And so she has this new hope at the end of chapter 2. I'm not trying to make Star Wars parallels here. I just realized that. Thank you for the 15 nerds that just laughed. Yeah. So Naomi has been advising Ruth, really instructing Ruth, that she should keep close to Boaz and his young women and then see where all this goes. Let's just see what happens. Stick close to Boaz and let's just see where this goes. But months later, instead of finding a new husband, all Ruth and Naomi really have for their efforts with Boaz is a plenty of grain. But we find that Naomi is determined. Look at her words to Ruth in verse 1 of chapter 3. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you?" What is Naomi wanting for Ruth? Rest. She tells us that in chapter 1 too. She said, you need to find rest. You need to find a husband so that you can find peace and rest, so that you can be taken care of. She wants Ruth to find rest and security and peace. And verse 2 tells us that Naomi knows that it's God's, that in God's law, there's a provision for this. In verse 2, she says, "Is not Boaz our relative with whose young women you were?" So Boaz stands in a position to be the kinsman redeemer, the one who can fill the role as husband and provide for the maintenance of the family name, and the preservation of the family inheritance. So clearly Naomi loves Ruth. Clearly Naomi has very good intentions for Ruth. She wants Ruth to be able to be taken care of. And it's important that we understand this. As we move through this chapter today, it's important that we understand Naomi has good intentions for Ruth. It's important that we know that, because Naomi makes some questionable instructions here, commands for Ruth that don't really look great. But we need to know her good intentions. Look at the rest of verse 2 through verse 5. He says, "See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash therefore and anoint yourself and put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." And she replied, "All that you say, I will do." So whatever Naomi's intentions are for Ruth, whatever her motive, she's obviously ready for something to happen. It's the end of the harvest. Ruth may not have the opportunities to spend every day with Boaz to continue kindling whatever flame might be there. And so she's ready for something to happen. It's now or never in Naomi's mind. Now there's a lot of discussion over Naomi's instructions to Ruth. There's quite a few scholars that would argue that in Naomi's desperation, she instructs Ruth to dress as a prostitute and go to Boaz and put him in a compromising position. And while I think Naomi's desperation, her insecurity, and her sin sometimes get the best of her, as we've seen so far, I'm not sure that's how far Naomi was going with this. The language here is very suspect, for sure. On the surface, it seems Naomi is offering Ruth some really scandalous instructions here. But if we look deeper into the context, I think there's a few things that we need to understand. Yes, Naomi's instructions to Ruth to go to the threshing floor, it was not uncommon during this part of the harvest season for men to sleep at the threshing floor when they were at the end of the harvest season, as they were gathering this grain and harvesting it for themselves. They wanted to protect the fruit of their labor. This is a time where thieves would seize an opportunity to rob them of their grains. And so they would sleep at the threshing floor to make sure that no one robbed them while they were there. So with that in mind, it was also common knowledge that prostitutes would make their way to the threshing floor, because they knew that there were a bunch of lonely men up there and that they may offer their services to. This was common knowledge in this time. So the threshing floor was already a scandalous place. And it's scandalous for sure that Naomi would instruct Ruth to go to the threshing floor at night, after she's bathed, after she's put on perfume, and she's put on a clean robe. So it seems a little scandalous. But what we need to understand is, to this point in the story, Ruth has been dressed in the garments of a mourning, grieving widow. She's lost her husband. This has been months. It's been maybe almost a year or longer since she's lost her husband. She's still grieving. She's still wearing the clothes of a grieving widow. And the instructions here are similar to what David did after mourning the death of his son. In 2 Samuel 12:20, we see that David bathed, he put on perfumed oil, he dressed in this simlah, which is a loose robe, and he went to the temple to worship. So it seems that what Naomi's instructing Ruth to do by taking a bath, putting on perfumed oil, and putting on new clothes is instructing her to move on from your mourning and move forward with your life. It's time to move from your mourning and move forward with your life. And perhaps Naomi's concluded that the reason Boaz has not been chasing after Ruth and trying to make something happen there is because he wanted to respect the mourning widow, a grieving widow. This was not uncommon for a man of character in this time to do. If there was a woman wearing grieving clothes or mourning garments, it would be inappropriate for him to make any advance at her. So by washing and perfuming herself and putting on her cloak, she was dressing not for seduction, but simply to say to Boaz, I am finished mourning. And so if you're at all interested, she wanted him to know that he didn't have to keep his distance any longer. But then Naomi gives her some more interesting instructions. Ruth is to go to the threshing floor at night, a place known for scandalous behavior at night, after Boaz is satisfied with food and wine and has fallen asleep, uncover his feet and lie down in bed with him. A little bit more scandalous. No doubt Boaz's drink would have been an alcoholic beverage, but our text doesn't lead us to believe that he was drunk, but he was satisfied. He was relaxed, he was in a good mood. Certainly enough to fall asleep rather quickly and pretty soundly because he didn't feel somebody get in the bed with him. And Naomi instructs her to make sure she watches closely where Boaz lies down. She doesn't want to get this part wrong. Make sure you know which bed is his. Because that could go real bad real fast. And then she is to uncover his feet. Now scholars debate what this means. What's this referencing to the uncovering of his feet? In the Old Testament, there's places where this exact phrase is used, and it's in the context of uncovering his nakedness. But Naomi is very careful in the words that she chooses. When we look at this, it almost looks like Genesis 38, when Tamar deceived Judah and she slept with him, her father-in-law. Look at Genesis 38, verse 12. In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. When Judah was comforted, he went up to Timnah to his sheep shears, and he and his friend Hurah, the Adullamite, and when Tamar was told, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep, she took off her widow's garments, covered herself with a veil, wrapping herself up, and sat at the entrance to Enam, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown up, and she was not been given to him in marriage. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had uncovered her face. And we'll stop there. If you're reading ahead, you'll see why. We'll keep it clean. The words used here in Ruth 3 are often used in a sexual context, meaning the entire lower half of the body. But in Daniel, the same words are used, and it's clearly and specifically used to describe the thigh and the feet. So if we give Naomi the benefit of the doubt here, she's instructing Ruth to uncover just his feet, to lie down at the foot of his bed, and then see what happens next. Just see where this goes. It still seems pretty scandalous. Naomi's advice to Ruth is full of moral danger. Twice now, back in chapter 2, verse 9, on the lips of Boaz, and on chapter 2, verse 22, on the lips of Naomi, they have talked about how dangerous it is for Ruth to be alone as a young single woman that she could be taken advantage of, that she could, men will take sexual advantage of her. This was a dark time in Israel's history. All you have to do is go back to the book before Ruth, to Judges, read the last chapter, and see how dark of a time this is in Israel's history. There's a lot of evil happening in Israel's, among Israel's people right now. There's a lot of darkness. There's a lot of sin. And this is a very dangerous time for a young, single woman to be alone. And it seems that Naomi is risking that. You add to that how Hosea 9 verse 1 describes the scandalous nature of the threshing floor, where it was known where prostitutes would go. This really seems alarming. And then you see the parallels of Genesis 19, and we begin to draw conclusions here that maybe the author is wanting us to go ahead and move our minds there. Because we do think about Tamar and Judah, and we do think about Genesis 19 and Lot's two daughters who get him drunk to have sex with him. To begin what? Who is the offspring, the firstborn child from this incestuous union? What's the name? Moab. A direct ancestor of Ruth. She's a Moabite. So we're beginning, our mind is already beginning to make these parallels. It's already beginning to go there. And I think the author is doing that intentionally for us because he wants us to see, is this going to turn out the same way? Is this story going to end with Ruth being a Moabite, just going back to her pagan ways, going back to the Moabite type and doing the exact same thing that we see the Moabites do throughout the Old Testament? Gratifying their flesh. Doing right in their own eyes is how Judges describes it. And so perhaps Naomi assumed if given the right circumstances, whatever happened, maybe Ruth would simply revert back to her Moabite ways and put Boaz in a compromising position where a decision would have to be made. Naomi was willing to risk a lot in this desperation. So verse 6, let's see what happens. So Ruth went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. Now, what does Jack say behold is? It's the same as I'll be doggone. And I'll be doggone, a woman was laying at his feet. Behold. So the sun sets in verse 6. And Ruth watches from the shadows as Boaz finally lays himself down. He's happy. He's tired. It's been a long day of working. The grain is piled high on the threshing floor. And she crept forward. She uncovered his feet. And she lay down just as her mother-in-law had told her to do. Lying down at his feet positioned herself as a servant. She was signaling to Boaz that she understood who she was, a Moabite, his servant, one who was probably not worthy to be there with him. In verse 8, at midnight, the man was startled. Makes sense. And he said, "Who are you? What's her response?" He says, "Who are you?" And she says, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." That's off script. That's not what Naomi told her to do. Naomi said, "Go in there. Uncover his feet, lie down at his feet, and follow his instructions. He will tell you what to do after that. See what happens. Let's just see how this plays out." But Ruth veers off of Naomi's plan. She goes in, she uncovers his feet, maybe so that the cold wind would wake him up. I don't know. She lays down at his feet, positioning herself as his slave. And he wakes up startled and says, "Who are you?" It's nighttime, he can't see. She may have something covering up her face. And she says, I am Ruth, your servant. She could have stopped there. In fact, if Naomi was playing all this out in her mind, that's where she should have stopped. Don't go any further than that. Let Boaz lead you. Let him tell you what to do. But Ruth doesn't stop there. She says, I am your servant, Ruth. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. The phrase that she uses, spread your wings over your servant, is a double entendre. It can also be translated, spread the corner of your garment over me. This is marriage language here. We see this in Ezekiel 16:8. It's a euphemism for the language that's used in the Hebrew Bible, that God himself uses it metaphorically to describe his covenant relationship with his people, Israel, as a marriage covenant. And so when Ruth says this, she's not trying. This makes it very clear to us. Ruth's intentions is not to seduce Boaz, but to propose to him. One scholar puts it this way. He says, this language signifies the establishment of a new relationship and the symbolic declaration of the husband to provide for the sustenance of the future wife. And that's what Ruth is asking for here. She's asking for peace, security, rest. She's asking for redemption and salvation. And by framing her proposal in these specific terms, she's actually quoting words from the first time that Boaz spoke to her when they first met. Back in chapter 2, verse 12, Boaz said that Ruth had come to take refuge under the wings of the Lord. And now Ruth says back to Boaz, spread your wings over your servant. Do you see what she's really asking him? She's asking that Boaz be the instrument of God's covenant love towards her by fulfilling the obligations to her as her redeemer. And one of the ways the Lord will extend and spread his wings over Ruth in covenant love is by Boaz spreading his wings over her in the covenant of marriage. And she really presses that upon him. She doesn't pull any punches. She wants to seal the deal. And so she says in verse 9, you are a redeemer. In other words, Boaz, whatever else there may be between us, understand clearly, this is your job. This is your duty under the law of Moses, that you are qualified uniquely to rescue me. You are qualified uniquely to rescue me. What a way to wake up. Like, what do you say? What do you do? I mean, you've just woken up to this strange woman in your bed and she starts proposing to you. Ruth has taken a huge risk. Talk about being vulnerable. What if Boaz responds negatively? What if he takes advantage of the moment? What if he doesn't live up to what we thought the character of Boaz was? What if he takes advantage of her and uses her for his own pleasure in that moment? Or what if he responds negatively and he thinks that she's coming in to prostitute herself and he sends her away in disgust, maybe publicly shaming her? Like, she's taking a huge risk. But she was willing to take this risk in this moment because what she knows of Boaz's character causes her to trust him. Enough to risk everything. And he responds in verse 10. He said, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, and that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. Now, Boaz is probably in his 80s at this point. Ruth is young enough, at least young enough to work in the fields all day long in the heat with enough energy to carry 80 pounds of barley on her back. She could have any guy she wanted, younger, stronger, better looking, but she chose him because for her, it was about who she could trust. For her, it was about character. And this was an act of chesed, this covenant love that we've been talking about. She was looking beyond the physical. In verse 11, and now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. That's really important. I want to come back to that in just a second. But look at verse 12. And now it is true that I am a redeemer, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning. So this tension builds. Things look promising, but there's one hurdle. Someone else is in line to be Ruth's kinsman redeemer, and he has a prior claim and responsibility. But nevertheless, because Boaz cares deeply for Ruth, because of the character and man of God that he is, he's determined to take care of this business as soon as the sun rises the next day. And so verse 14, so she lay at his feet until the morning. What has she already found? Rest. So she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another. And he said, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. And he said, bring the garment you are wearing and hold it out. So she held it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into the city. So to prevent suspicions about her activities at night on the threshing floor where Boaz slept, before dawn broke, she gets up to leave so nobody sees her. He's awake, and under the dark sky, he initiates a second conversation. He supports her efforts to get away without being noticed. But what did Boaz call her? In his first response to her after her proposal, what does he call her? He calls her a worthy woman. There's only 2 other places this is found in the Old Testament, this exact same phrase, haset hayil, woman of worth. The only other 2 places that is found is Proverbs 12:4 and Proverbs 31:10, both describing an excellent wife and a woman of God. Boaz not only knew the worthiness of Ruth, her character, but he wanted to keep it intact. He wanted to protect it. Do you see how Boaz is handling all of this with such dignity and wisdom and gentleness? In verse 15, he tells her to bring the cloak with which she had covered herself in the night, and he fills it with 6 measures of barley. This is a lot of barley, so much that he has to help her put it into her cloak. It's extremely heavy. She goes back home. In verse 16, she comes and approaches Naomi. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did you fare, my daughter? And the question that she actually asks is the same question that Boaz asks in the Hebrew. It's the same question. The question Boaz asks in the middle of the night is the question Naomi first asked to Ruth in the morning. Who are you, my daughter? Here's what she's asking. Has Boaz changed your life forever? Are you a different Ruth approaching me today than the Ruth that left me last night? Are you different? Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. She replied, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. So here's the punchline at the end of the story. Boaz said to me, here's what Ruth says. Boaz said to me, you must not go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed. Now, Naomi thought that she was being subtle here. She's playing matchmaker. She's getting a little impatient. She's at the point where this is it. It's now or never. We've got to do something. And so she's behind the scenes kind of manipulating situations, trying to make something happen here. She gives Ruth a very specific set of plans, very specific set of instructions, and tells her to go do it. Ruth veers off of it a little bit. But I think Boaz has picked up on what Naomi is doing. And I think Boaz is sending Ruth a message by not sending, or sending Naomi a message by not sending Ruth home empty-handed. She's sending a message to Naomi. He says, don't go back empty-handed. Now, how does Naomi describe herself earlier in the book of Ruth. She said, I went away full, but I have come back what? Empty. I think Boaz is saying something very specific to Naomi. That you don't need to manipulate the circumstances out of your insecurity and your fear. You really can trust God to provide. This massive haul of barley was a kind of visual aid, a dramatized promise of that fact. Boaz will change not just Ruth, but Naomi forever. You'll no longer be empty. You will be full and overflowing. And in the last line of the chapter, it looks like Naomi is beginning to understand. So she gives up her scheming. She gives up her manipulating situations. And she gives up her bitterness. And it seems that at last she is content to simply wait and see, to trust that another would act for her. There's quite a few things that we can take from Ruth chapter 3. As we've been moving through this book we're almost done. And I find myself most of the time identifying with Naomi. Because Naomi has these moments where she's acting in great faith, and you really see her understanding of who God is play out. And then there's these moments where she just stops and throws her hands up and says, all right, God, I can't trust you in this. I'm going to have to do this myself. So she's got this controlling nature about her that I often find myself identifying with, trying to manipulate situations or making things happen because of what I believe the right outcome should be. And so in order for us to get here, I've got to do this to get there, rather than wait and see what does God want and how is he going to get us there. And we see this play out in our families and in our relationships and at work. And we begin to throw our hands up and say, God, I can't trust you. I'm going to do it. And it's like we bring on the spirit of Naomi and we begin to say the end just justifies the means. This is the outcome I want. So whatever we need to do to get there, whatever compromises we have to make, how does this play out in our life? There are so many areas that I can look in my life and see, I've just said the end justifies the means. And we can see it in our relationships, in our families, in our workplace, in our politics. This is where we should be, and we can't trust God to get us there. So we're going to compromise our integrity, our character, our values, our principles, our knowledge of who God is, so that we can get ourselves there. In other words, we say to God, you can't do it. Let me do it for you. What a dangerous place to be. In fact, in those moments where we recognize those parts in our life, it should scare us to repentance. Because I know what I'm capable of. And in the end, the only thing that I'm capable of is my own demise. And I've seen time and time again where God has delivered his promises in my life and he's shown me his goodness. And it's like that happens and I turn away and I just forget. And I just say, I can't trust you. I am one of those people that if I want it done right, I'm going to do it myself. And it's the same often in my relationship with God. And where I want to find myself is identifying with Ruth. Because here's what we see Ruth. Ruth goes into the night and she uncovers Boaz's feet and she lays herself down at his feet, positioning herself as a slave. But that's where she veers from the plan. She veers from the plan and she says, I am your servant, but I want to be your bride. It's like in that moment, we see this transformation happen with Ruth. And she says, I no longer want to be a slave. I know you have something better. I know that you can redeem me. And I want to identify with Ruth, rather being the antithesis of Ruth and saying, I would rather be a slave than a servant of Christ, a child of God, a redeemed heart. And how many times do we find ourselves remaining in our slavery to our addictions, our fears, our insecurities, saying, I would rather be here than take the risk of surrendering to Christ. Boaz had every right to reject Ruth. She was a Moabite. She was a widow. He could have rejected her. He could have rejected her publicly and would have been within his legal rights to do it. He had no obligation to Ruth. In fact, as we're going to see in the next chapter, I don't want to spoil it for you, but Ruth finds rejection from other people because of the baggage that comes with marrying Ruth. And where she sees in her own life maybe baggage, maybe unworthiness, Boaz saw something desirable. He saw someone he wanted to be in relationship with. And how many times do we run from the presence of Christ because we don't feel worthy of the gospel of Christ? And I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with people who tell me they understand the gospel. And they say, yeah, I'm a Christian. I understand the gospel in my life. And then as they begin to explain the gospel in their life, it's very clear they don't understand the gospel. Because they start talking about all the bad things that they've done and all the things that they're doing to try to make up for those bad things. And they start talking, well, you know, I don't go to church as much as I should, but, you know, I'm trying to work on that and just be better so that I can, you know, be more worthy. And I have had conversations with people that says, I'm not a Christian yet because I don't feel like I'm worthy yet for that, but I'm working on it. That's not the gospel. That's not the gospel that we see. Even in this relationship, even in this conversation between Boaz and Ruth, we are presented very clearly with what the gospel looks like. And where we see brokenness, where we see baggage, where we see unworthiness, we see a Christ that looks at us with desire in his eyes and says, I want relationship with you. I want you to be my bride. I want to enter into a covenant with you where all the risk is on me. And what Ruth understood about Boaz, what she understood about his character and who she is, allowed her to trust Boaz enough to risk her pride, to risk her reputation, to risk her life to become his bride. Because she had decided, I'm no longer going to be a slave. Christ longs for us to take refuge under his wings. He longs for us to surrender to him. And in those moments, maybe even as we walk into these doors and sing these songs, we begin to think about all of the sin in our lives. And that's not a bad thing. Because I think it's good for us to recognize who we are, but not to stop there. Recognize who Christ has made us by his blood, by his cross, by his righteousness. That those of us who have surrendered to Christ and find ourselves in him, we are royalty. The Bible says we are co-heirs with Jesus to the eternal throne of God. But most of us would rather live as slaves than as future kings and queens. And this Bible clearly describes who we are. But we choose not to live as who we are. Ruth had had enough. And she says, Boaz, you are the one that can rescue me. I truly believe that there are people that are in this room this morning that need to just stop and say, Christ, you are the only one that can rescue me. And I can't do it. And then you just stop trying and let Christ change you. Because you can't earn your righteousness. Left to ourselves, the best that we get is death. But in Christ, we find rest. We find peace. We find security. We find redemption. Church, I'm going to ask you just to move into an attitude of prayer and worship. And I want us to just spend a moment. Brad's going to lead us in a song. And before you start singing, before you stand or anything like that, I would ask you just to take a moment to examine your heart. What areas of your life are you choosing to be a slave? What areas of your life have you not risked surrendering to Christ? Maybe you're here this morning and you realize how desperate you are for Christ for the first time. We'd love the opportunity to pray with you, to tell you what it means to become a Christ follower. What does it look like to be in relationship with Jesus? Are you willing to risk everything because of what you know of Christ? I love what C.S. Lewis describes, how he describes Jesus in the books of Narnia, imaging him as Aslan. And the children ask, is he safe? No, he's not safe, but he's good. You can trust him. Where are you like Naomi in your own life? Where you're trying to manipulate and control outcomes and you've thrown up your hands and says, well, the end just justifies the means. However I can get myself to that point. What are you compromising? How do you surrender control? I would encourage you to place that at the feet of the cross this morning. And maybe some of you for the first time need to say, Jesus, rescue me. We're going to ask some folks in this back corner to my left, just out of the way, if you want the opportunity to pray. Some of our staff is going to be back there. They would love the opportunity to pray with you, whatever it is. Maybe you want to pray for someone. Maybe your own life. Maybe you want to know what it means to follow Jesus. They would love that opportunity to do that. And when Brad starts singing, you feel free to move. Feel free to move now. Let's remain in an attitude of prayer and worship. Let's go to the Father this morning and let's respond to him for his goodness. Father, we thank you for the raw story that we see throughout the book of Ruth. An honest depiction of who we are. Even as those who have been redeemed by you, Father, there's still this tension between the kingdom of God in our lives and the flesh that we battle every day. God, we feel it and we fight it. God, may we stop fighting alone. May we surrender to you. May we trust you. You are trustworthy. And you're worthy of our worship. And you're worthy of our lives, and you're worthy of our surrender, and you alone can rescue us. God, for those that are in here that have not made a decision to surrender their lives, to follow after you, to begin this journey. God, may today be the day of their salvation. May they find themselves trusting you, trusting in the righteousness of Christ as their hope. And God, I pray that everyone in here this morning finds peace and rest that only comes from you. May we experience your goodness. May we taste and see that you are good. May we no longer remain in slavery to our sin. May we find ourselves as co-heirs, living as co-heirs to the eternal throne of God.